99.5 FM, WBAI New York, and on the internet at WBAI.org. It is 5 o'clock. The program you just heard, Labrish with Haptah Selassie, will be back next week at 2, following the work of the Midnight Ravers. And stay tuned for Back of the Book, right here.
Got to build up.
Hello, this is Radio's Uncle Sidney. When I'm out and about, folks comes up to me and says, "You should be ashamed." But when they calms down, they says how much they loves WBAI. That's WBAI New York and WBAI.org. Back in the day, we had commentaries by Malcolm X, Ayn Rand, Abby Hoffman, and William F. Buckley Jr. Imagine them folks in the same room at the same time. Nowadays, we've got Bob Fass, the founder of the feast. Amy Goodman, you know her, we got her. Michio Kaku, the smartest guy in the world. Shows that helps you not to get evicted. Top-of-the-line news and interviews. Insane artists and musicians. Well, okay, okay, we went nuts for a while back there. But now we're okay. We're like your crackhead cousin that's making good. So we know you're pulling for us. Go, go, run right now to WBAI.org and look around. See where we've gone. You can even subscribe online. Believe me, you'll be glad you did. Stay tuned.
It's probably about 5 a.m., and you're listening to all. We're flying on Mars! Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Well, good goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear, and a hearty hello to our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about a few things here, and you can find out a little bit more about what we're going to talk about by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com, where you can look around at things. When you get there, you'll see a blue navigation frame on the left-hand side of your screen, and at the top of that, it will say Latest Back of the Book Program Links. That is a link. Click on that. You will get to the webpage for this morning's radio program. The WBAI website and the archives seem to be functioning. This is our 40th pandemic episode of Back of the Book, a round figure. It's a pre-recorded program. This program was recorded on Friday for airing on Saturday morning. If things have happened between then and when you're hearing this program, we won't be referencing them on this program. A recorded program cannot be as up-to-date as a live program, but we have to do it this way in these dangerous times. And the top story of this past week for the entire world and probably even the entire multiverse is... we've popped back up to 107 followers on Twitter. Oh, it's huge. You got, we had dropped down to 106. Now we're back up to 107. Just gigantic. And, you know, the gravitational waves from it are going out there and really doing things. The next public WBAI local station board meeting is scheduled to be held on Wednesday, May 12th, 2021 at 7 p.m. on Zoom, even though Zoom compromises privacy and security. And according to Johns Hopkins website, COVID-19 cases in the whole world reached 145,202,877 on Friday afternoon, and global deaths reached 3,077,900. In America, the number of cases as of Friday was 31,985,005, and the death toll in America was 571,091. So 5,091 people have died of COVID-19 in America since our last program 1 week ago. This is interesting because now the death rate is trending much lower. It had been higher. It was coming down and coming down. Then it kind of hit that plateau Dr. Fauci talks about. Then it went up for a couple of weeks there. And so this is much lower than what we've been seeing. Last time it was over 9,000, and this time it's 5,000 and change. So, okay. We're still under 10,000 dead in America per week for the sixth week in a row. I suspect that people getting vaccinated is having its effect on the pandemic, at least in America so far. And I'm seeing reports on the news that more people are getting infected, though. But we have the lowest number of deaths in 1 week that we've seen in a long time. I don't know. I guess we got to look at this and see how this keeps going. See if the numbers next week are low again or if they're high again. I don't know. I don't know why we've got two different kinds of things happening at once here. By the time this program airs on Saturday morning, all of those figures are going to be higher. And we're seeing that places are just saying, hey, nobody really wants to get the shots right now. And a whole load of people are just not showing up. So what's going on with that? Are they all anti-vaxxer cuckoos? Or are people just saying, oh, it's over, I don't have to get one? We saw some people on the TV news recently. Some of them are just flat-out anti-vaxxers. And others are saying, well, you know, you can get all these, you can get sick off this, and I don't want to risk that. It's a million to one. You're more likely to get struck by lightning than you are to get a blood clot from that Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And the others aren't really doing much at all. Also, again, the infection rate for people who've gotten vaccinated for getting COVID-19 after that is 0.008%, which is really quite good. And so I don't know when you get, we also saw one selfish person say, well, everybody else is going to get vaccinated, so that'll be it. And I won't have to worry. And I won't have to take a risk of me getting sick. You're not really taking a risk anyway, but you're going to walk around and say, let everybody else protect me. Well, good luck with that, because if the virus comes flying around and it finds you, hoo-hoo.
This is just like at the beginning of the pandemic when you'd walk up to a store with essential services and there'd be another person there and they'd wait for you to open the door because they didn't want to touch the door handle. This is this to the nth degree. Yes, and it's just completely, again, stupid and selfish because here are vaccines that work and you're taking a bigger risk not getting vaccinated.
And in other pandemic news, Gao Fu, the director of the Chinese CDC, Centers for Disease Control, said the vaccines produced by the so-called People's Republic of China, quote, don't have very high protection rates, unquote. Gao said it may be time for the country to change its vaccination strategy by having other countries' vaccines distributed in the so-called People's Republic of China. That's probably a good idea. We're not hearing the same thing coming out of Russia, but I kind of think that Russia's got the same thing going on. I mean, part of the reason why I think some of these places have these other vaccines, it's because they hacked the people who were producing them in the first place. And when you do stuff like that, you don't always get the best information there. It'd probably be good if China went and, you know, saw other producers. And Pfizer is apparently discounting the vaccine for India to what they call a not-for-profit level, because India is getting a big surge right now, and healthcare in India isn't exactly universal and great. For Pickles of the North and myself, this next week will mark 2 full weeks after Pickles of the North got her second Pfizer vaccine shot. We're seriously talking about going out for mere fun next week. We haven't done that in well over a year. And of course, I got my second shot 7 or 8 weeks ago now. So by next week, Pickles of the North and I should both be as immune as we can get to this particular virus.
Yes, that'll be great. I want to just add here that across the border in Canada, where they're concentrating on giving everybody just one shot because they figure that'll offer more protection and help keep the numbers down. Well, now it's time, after 4 months, for the very earliest people who were vaccinated, the most vulnerable in nursing homes. I thought they'd all gotten their second shots. Apparently not. They made a bunch of them wait 4 months. So now there's no Pfizer vaccine available for them. So they're going to have the Moderna or vice versa. At this moment, I can't remember. Anyway, they're going to mix vaccines.
Oh, I don't know that that's a smart idea at all.
Oh, well, they're saying, no, it's going to be fine. And apparently the health people in Canada are saying, well, yes, it'll probably be fine. And
probably be fine.
Well,
okay.
Well, I'm not quoting them directly, but yeah. They're saying, oh, well, you know, that I don't even know. I don't know what to say about
it. I don't know. Maybe you can do that. I don't know. I mean, I would really want to make sure and have the scientists look at that idea before I implemented it on a nationwide level among tens of millions of people.
Well, there you go. And at least until they get more supplies in.
And now it's time for the back of the book news from Mars. Okay, Ingenuity, that's the name of that little helicopter that they sent up to Mars. It was, well, sort of piggybacked. It was underneath the Mars Perseverance rover, which is like the size of a car. Big car. So it's up there, and it was dropped onto the ground a week or two ago. And Ingenuity is the first ever attempt to fly an aircraft on another planet. And they attempted this on Monday, April 19th. That's this past Monday. Pickles of the North and I got up early, and we got NASA TV going on the computer. We knew that whatever had happened with the Ingenuity chopper had already happened at about 3:30 in the morning, but NASA couldn't get the data from the Perseverance rover until about 3 hours later. So we got NASA TV on the computer, and we sat there and we watched it. And we had to really go to YouTube, unfortunately. I don't like to go to YouTube. But we went to YouTube and we watched the coverage. And the reason why the video hadn't been sent to Earth until 3 full hours after the historic attempt had happened was because the Perseverance rover, which is what had taken the video of what had happened and to which Ingenuity had sent its own data, had to wait for 3 hours until the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter had arrived in a position where it could get all of the information from Perseverance and then beam it to Earth. So there's a little traffic issue here with spacecraft and satellites and all of this stuff. This is really science fiction stuff. Yeah, the thing on Mars has to wait till the satellite that's orbiting Mars comes over it so it can use its low-power antenna to send the information to the satellite, and then the satellite beams it to the Earth. Oh, man. So, NASA TV came on at 6:15 in the morning, and NASA then started having interviews with people like the project manager for Ingenuity. Her name is Mimi Aung, and Ms. Aung was very chipper about it all. She did acknowledge that there was the possibility of a total failure and said what they'd do in that case. She also talked about what they'd do if there were a partial failure. And she expressed her hope that the experiment would be a total success. And this thing is an experiment. They also talked to the guy who would get the data as it came down. Because it's all very complicated stuff. And they have to make sure about this. It's not like downloading some little thing from somewhere on the internet. No internet here. The mission control people had sent the program for Ingenuity to autonomously take off, hover, and land to the Perseverance rover on Sunday. The rover then sent the program to Ingenuity. And the Ingenuity helicopter cost about $85 million, by the way. It included what the New York Times described as an, quote, almost off-the-shelf Qualcomm processor, unquote. Qualcomm is a company, that's the name of a company, and they make microprocessors, which are the brainy parts of a lot of computers and other devices that need to process data. The particular Qualcomm processor that was installed as the brains of Ingenuity was originally designed for use in cell phones. The New York Times says that it has more computing power than all of the previous interplanetary spacecraft combined, which is very interesting. And the reason for this is that NASA has a protocol of only using proven electronics on spacecraft, and so they're a mandatory decade or more behind current technology. Ingenuity needed as much computing power as possible because it was going to fly without any human help. And flying a helicopter is not the easiest thing in the world, whether the world is the Earth or Mars. This Qualcomm processor wasn't modified to function in the cold temperatures of Mars, and it had flown through space where there's a lot of serious radiation. The surface of Mars is much more flooded with ionizing radiation than the Earth is, too. So the processor is lucky that it survived the trip.
So do you know what they do to would do to something like that ordinarily to make sure that it was protected? Do they encase it in I don't know, what do they encase things in?
As far as I know, what they do is, yeah, they armor it up. They put steel and lead around it sometimes, although that's a hell of a thing, putting lead around something that you're going to spend a lot of money to loft into another planet. And every gram that you put into space costs a lot of money in rocket fuel.
And it would make it heavier, too.
Well, that's exactly my point.
Yeah. The little helicopter, though, would make it heavier.
Yes, the little helicopter would be heavier, too. So as far as I know, that's mostly what they do, is they find ways to put stuff around it. And Qualcomm processor, they didn't do any adapting or anything. There are some very sophisticated things they can do when they make their own processors and their own integrated circuits. But as they say, this is almost off the shelf, as the New York Times put it.
So the fact that it survived, and not only survived, it's working in tip-top condition, it looks like. That means maybe they will be able to do this for other programs going to other planets with little helicopters attached.
Maybe. I think their preference is going to be to roll their own and to make the processors themselves, which they then build from the ground up so that it doesn't have call waiting on it or whatever the hell is that.
This is
a cell phone processor. This is the heart of a cell phone.
Boy, that's amazing. And also it's a continuation in the line of how all the tech that got Apollo to the moon was less sophisticated than the early cell phones.
Oh, yeah, sure. So Pickles and I were watching NASA TV there, and there were video illustrations of what the scientists and engineers expected to happen with Ingenuity and stuff like that. They had interviews with various people. They had a young woman on there narrating stuff, and there were a lot of women involved in this. The presenters, or whatever they were called, and spokespeople were both women. Mimi Aung is a woman, and she's the person in charge of Ingenuity. So there were more women than we were used to seeing in the past. And I think that's the result of some things that have happened in the past few years. So we're watching this stuff, and all of this is going on. It's kind of filler, I suppose, but it's also somewhat educational. And we're there saying, oh boy, we want to see this. We want to see this. And then at about 6:34 a.m., the guy in charge of getting the data downloaded says he's gotten a signal from Perseverance. Woohoo! We're, you know, oh boy, here we go. And NASA, by the way, says that Mars was about 173 million miles from Earth on Monday. So the signal traveling at the speed of light took around 15 and a half minutes to get from Perseverance on Mars to the folks at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on Earth. And Pickles and I were watching the guy doing the downloading. And we were watching the guy next to him to see if there was anything revealed by their behavior while the data came down. And you could see there was just screen after screen of numbers. That's what it's all going to be. And NASA provided some more commentary by people to fill that time. And the commentators told us that the first indication of what had happened, whether it had failed or succeeded or whatever, would be a small graph that ought to show the Ingenuity helicopter going up, hovering for a time, and then coming down. It would be a pretty simple graph. And then, after quite a bit of waiting, it seemed like, the guy getting the data said that the graph image had come down and the whole thing was nominal, which means it was exactly what they wanted. And at that point, everybody at JPL starts whooping it up, and Ingenuity's project manager, Mimi Aung, could be seen cheering and ripping up some papers. I think she was tearing up the failure and partial failure speeches, what she was doing, which is sort of like what happened on D-Day. On D-Day, the general in charge, Dwight David Eisenhower, later president of the United States, Eisenhower, a Supreme Allied commander, had prepared two speeches. One where it was going well and D-Day was okay and they were charging onto the beaches, and another one where they'd been thrown back by the Nazis and D-Day had failed. And he recorded both on discs in those days, because the Allies didn't have audio tape to record on. That was something only the Nazis had. And they used it to have Hitler record speeches, and then they'd bring it somewhere and play it. That way the Allies wouldn't know where Hitler was. And, you know, because if Hitler comes on and just says, and of course he was a blowhard, so he would go on for an hour talking. And if he gets a, hello, this is Adolf Hitler, whoopee, and starts doing that, the Allies are going to send a 1,000-plane raid over there right away and blow up wherever the hell the signal's coming from. And so what they did was they had him record it in a basement somewhere, and then they put it in a plane and flew it someplace else, sometimes hundreds of miles away, so the Allies would hear the broadcast coming through. And to them, audio tape was new, so they didn't know if he was really that far away or what. And so, that's something they did. And so this is another case of... And of course, with D-Day, they played after they said, "Okay, we're on the beaches." They played the one where it's a success. Years later, somebody unearthed the recording of Eisenhower saying, "You know, this is terrible. We've been blown up and all that." And so that got around somewhere, and I guess it still exists. But anyway, so this is another example of somebody having preparations for failure and success, and she tore up her failure speech.
And this is also what was done for Apollo 11. the first moon landing. They had a speech prepared to be read by the then president in case the astronauts could not leave the surface of the moon. And it's quite something to read.
And we're doomed to die there.
Yes.
The landing module would have been where they died.
Yes.
Ugh. Yeah. Anyway, so she tore up her failure speeches. And then NASA showed the video that Perseverance had shot. And it was pretty low resolution, but it showed the little helicopter rising up, hovering for a while, and coming right back down. It's not the most dramatic looking event, but it was quite the accomplishment. Ingenuity had risen into the Martian atmosphere by about 10 feet, and hovered there for a little over 30 seconds, and then it had landed safely. So the engineers did a lot of work on Ingenuity. They had to keep it as light as possible, of course. We mentioned this before, which is why there was no armor around the Qualcomm processor. So the tiny helicopter weighed only 4 pounds altogether. It used a pair of counter-rotating propeller blades that had to spin at about 2,500 RPM to get it airborne in that extremely thin atmosphere. And the Martian atmosphere is so thin that there's no place you can go to on Earth where the air is that thin. So they had to experiment in a laboratory where they basically used a vacuum pump to pump the air out of the little chamber and see if they could make this thing fly. And yeah, if a human being were to go there, even the Sherpas, the people who live in the high Himalayan mountains, they'd be dead pretty rapidly because there's just not enough air on the Martian surface. And of course, the air would be almost all carbon dioxide anyway, so it wouldn't work. Anyway, the Martian air is very thin, and so the blades had to be specially designed, the helicopter blades. There are two sets, and they counter-rotate. One goes one way, one goes the other way. There are two reasons for this. One, if you have only one set and it just turns, you're going to end up turning the Ingenuity payload itself. The little 4-pound thing down there is going to turn. So you need something to counter the torque, as it's called. In regular helicopters, you will see they have another rotator on the back at the tail of the helicopter, and it's at the tail and it's smaller. And the reason is because by putting it at right angles and far away, you get more leverage, so they don't have to have a rotor on the helicopter that's as big as the helicopter blade that's lifting it up. But they didn't have that luxury with Ingenuity, so what they did was they had two counter-rotating blades. And the other part of it is that you actually can get more lift that way, which they needed all the lift they could get at it, I think. So the blades themselves are about 4 feet long, and they're made of a carbon fiber outer shell with some sort of a special foam interior to make them strong and light. So after all of the cheering was over, Mimi Aung made her success speech. She made her success speech and said, quote, "We together flew at Mars, and we together now have this Wright Brothers moment," unquote. And then she said, quote, "We will take a moment to celebrate our success, and then take a cue from Orville and Wilbur regarding what to do next. History shows that they got back to work to learn as much as they could about their new aircraft, and so will we." And Pickles and I were thrilled to be watching this historic event. There was a second test scheduled for Thursday morning, and I was up looking at the NASA TV website again. I was there just after 5 o'clock, like 1 or 2 minutes after 5 o'clock in the morning, but they apparently never did a live broadcast of that second flight. And the second flight occurred around 5:30 a.m. that day. So I would have been there on time, but they didn't do it. NASA later announced that on Thursday, Ingenuity's second test flight lasted for 51.9 seconds. The helicopter climbed to 16 feet this time and executed a 5-degree tilt so that the rotors moved it horizontally in the air for 7 feet. Then it righted itself and landed. It was up there for slightly longer time there, 51.9 seconds. So, yeah, like another 20 seconds or so, 21 seconds of flight in there. And they have named the spot on Mars where Ingenuity is taking off from and landing back on. They've named it Wright Brothers Field. There are three more flights scheduled for Ingenuity. Each will involve it going farther. Ms. Aung wants to really test the limits of this thing. And if it gets wrecked, you know, it isn't going to be that big a deal because they'll have the information from it, probably. But they probably won't wreck it. They'll probably leave it there. And a long time from now, somebody will show up and grab that as a souvenir. Somebody will sell it on a future eBay. Oh, my. Let's hope not. Well, we've been successfully invading Mars for decades now. There's a passage from H.G. Wells' 1897 serialized novel, The War of the Worlds, that sort of relates to the latest accomplishment on Mars. And in it, the unnamed protagonist of the story has been witnessing the Martian invasion of the Earth for more than 2 weeks. He meets a British military artillery sergeant whom he'd met previously, and the unnamed protagonist says, quote, "Have you seen any Martians? Since I crawled out..." "They've gone away across London," the sergeant said. "I guess they've got a bigger camp there. Of a night, all over there, Hempstead way, the sky is alive with their lights. It's like a great city, and in the glare, you can just see them moving. By daylight, you can't. But nearer, I haven't seen them..." He counted on his fingers. 5 days. "Then I saw a couple across Hammersmith way carrying something big. And the night before last..." The sergeant stopped and spoke impressively. "It was just a matter of lights. But it was something up in the air. I believe they've built a flying machine and are learning to fly." I stopped on hands and knees, for we had come to the bushes. "Fly?" "Yes," he said, "fly." I went on into a little bower and sat down. "It's all over with humanity," I said. "If they can do that, they will simply go round the world." He nodded. "They will." And there we are, we're invading Mars, and we're doing exactly what Wells predicted the Martians would do here, experiment with flying. Oh, my, oh, my. So, yeah, it's very nice. We're glad that we got to see all that, and this is good stuff. It was nice relief during a pandemic. Yeah. And there's other Mars news. The other day, the Perseverance rover was able to extract oxygen from the Martian atmosphere. That atmosphere of Mars is 96% carbon dioxide. The amount of oxygen extracted was only about 5 grams, but with this technology, scaled up considerably, oxygen could be extracted and stored for astronauts to breathe, and it could also be used for making rocket fuel for the return trip, or for the exploration of other places beyond Mars. So they're doing all sorts of experiments, and this is the first time they've done this. They've managed to crack oxygen out of the carbon dioxide of Mars. There's a lot of oxygen on Mars. It's just that it's combined with other things like carbon in the atmosphere and iron and other molecules and elements on the ground. This is why Mars is red. It's rusty.
And speaking of science fiction writers and Mars, the landing site for Perseverance has been named after the science fiction writer Octavia E. Butler. So that was really a great thing.
Uh-huh. And right about now, I think it's time for us to do a station break. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a transmitter and antenna atop 4 Times Square, going through a new studio somewhere in downtown Brooklyn and originating in our living room somewhere else in Brooklyn. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. And you can find out more by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can also go to the official website of this radio station at WBAI.org. Okay, I should pitch. This is WBAI New York, and at WBAI, one of the things we do is we start begging you for money. We're infamous for that. But we have to do it. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio, which means we aren't selling you farm implements. We're not selling you cars. We're not selling you trucks. We're not selling you all sorts of different strange things. What we do is we get on the air and we beg you for some dough. Listener sponsored is not just a slogan. And so we ask you, the listeners, to help support this radio station financially. It's a really important thing to do. And so what we ask you to do is get up, go to your phone, dial 1-212-209-2950 and tell the operator who picks up at the call center, tell that person that you want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. Now, if you want to become a BAI buddy, what is that? What's a BAI buddy? A BAI buddy is the name we have for a sustaining membership, which means you donate to the radio station on a monthly basis, on a regular basis. And what happens is you call up the call center at 1-212-209-2950. You say you want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book, and you tell them how much you would like to donate every month. You can donate $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month, $20 a month. You could do more, but those are the rates we expect most of our listeners to go for. And so you tell them you want to donate whatever amount of money a month you want to donate, and you also tell them what day of the month you want to be charged for it. And on that date, your credit card or your debit card will be charged for that amount of money. Now, hey, $5 a month, wow, that's not much at all there. You could do $5 a month probably. It's $60 for a whole year. 1-212-209-2950. You can also call up that same number and say you want to make a one-time donation in the name of Back of the Book. And then you don't have it every month. You just say, I want to donate X amount of money right now, one time. And if you donate $25 or more, you get to vote in the LSB elections, which are going to start in, I think it's 2 months or something. The date of record will be in June sometime. And I think maybe in July they start the actual. Yeah, they're going to have to wait till July, because something I can't talk about is going to be having an election through all of June. So sometime in July, or I don't know, maybe even late July or early August, there will be an election for the local station board, and it would be really good if people were able to elect decent members to it instead of disruptors from certain cultic groups. So, yeah, 1-212-209-2950. Please give us a call at that number. Call us now and say, hey, I want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. Or say, I want to make a one-time donation to WBAI in the name of Back of the Book. And it's good to say that you're doing this for Back of the Book, because then we get credit for it. And we don't get money from this or anything. However, management is looking at what programs raise money. And programs that don't raise money are liable to not be around much longer. And if we can raise money, we can survive. We're fairly sure of that. All right, 1-212-209-2950. And if you become a BAI buddy, you get the new WBAI tote/grocery bag. Oh, boy. And, you know, you could walk around and, as I said last time, put your communist literature in there and hand it out from a BAI tote bag. Everybody will be impressed and they'll all become communists with you, I'm sure. And also, you could put your groceries in such a bag and say, look at this. On top of that, there are all sorts of offers for discounts on things if you're a BAI buddy. And you have to go up to the website, WBAI.org, and look around there and see what's being offered. Because I can't keep up with it. There's a lot of stuff up there. So, yes, 1-212-209-2950. If you could please call that number now, it would really help everybody out a whole lot. 1-212-209-2950, and when you call them up, you can tell the folks at the call center, I want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book, and tell them whether you want to donate $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month, or $20 a month, and tell them what day of the month you want to be charged. And again, 1-212-209-2950. That's the number to call, and it's a local number again. So please, please, if you could call that number, it would really help us out a great deal. Final time for this pitch, 1-212-209-2950. Thank you. We hope that some of you are pledging to us at this point in time. And in watching out online and near online, the National Cybersecurity Center has issued its annual chastisement for people using weak passwords. People are using easy-to-guess passwords, including their pet's name, family members' names, significant dates, their favorite sports teams, or, of course, even just the word password. Yeah, password is a popular one, as well as QWERTY and 123456. People keep using these, even though they're told, don't do that. The National Cybersecurity Center suggests that 15% of people have used their pet's name as their password at some point. Luckily, I don't have a pet. While 14% have used the name of a family member. Uncle Goofy! Oh, no. Yeah, that's a famous old Sid Caesar skit from, oh, God, it's 70 years ago, I think. Oh, man. Anyway, yes, Uncle Goofy was on that, and I saw it one time, and I thought it was completely hilarious. The next time I saw it, it was sort of okay, but it wasn't, you know, didn't make me fall over. Oh, well. Anyway, so 14% are using the name of a family member, like Uncle Goofy, and a further 13% of people have used a significant date, such as a birthday or anniversary, while 6% have used the sports team they support as a password. So, if someone knows you at all, they have a really good chance of guessing your password. And if you're online and telling everyone on some huge social media platform all about yourself and the details of your life, that information could end up in the hands of malicious hackers who could break into all sorts of things that you use passwords for. Criminals also use software to what's called brute force a password, which is where the software just keeps trying a password one after another with the hopes that it will eventually break through. And if you use a weak one-word password, those people can have a really good chance at success. There's also something called a dictionary attack, where software is used to throw in common words as a password, and if you use one of those, you're really easy prey. Not only do some people use weak passwords, but some people use the same weak password for multiple things. Not a bright idea. So someone might use the same password for their Facebook password. Facebook, I wouldn't go near that thing. And they use it for also their bank account. Yeah, Facebook and your bank account have the same password. Not a good idea. So if someone gets your Facebook password by guessing based on what information about yourself you've revealed, they'll also probably try that same password out on other accounts you have, like your bank account. And if you put a lot of your personal information out online, people may know what bank you use. So if at some point you complained about your bank, the Temple of Doom Trust Company, for instance, online, and you complain about how they gouged you on banking fees, the people who've grabbed at least one of your passwords will know where to try it out next. This is some of the danger we run into when we go up to social media platforms and we start saying, oh, here's all sorts of information. Here's my favorite sports team. Oh, boy. Go, mugwarts. Go, earthworms. Earthworms, go. Yes, I want to see the earthworms win the divisional title. Yeah, go, earthworms. Well, people know what you might be using for a password. And so, yeah, they might know you're using earthworms as your password, and they'll also know you're using it on Facebook, and they'll know what bank you bank at, and so they'll say, let's see if this works. And if you use it in both those places, it'll work. So the National Cybersecurity Center is telling people to create their passwords by using three random words to help secure their accounts. Of course, random, real random, is very hard to do. Something hard to guess is better than nothing, though. And you should make a password for each account that you have to use a password on, a different password for each account. And that's going to lessen the damage if one of them gets compromised. The National Cybersecurity Center suggests that while three words is easy to remember, it's harder to crack. They also recommend getting and using password managing software. That type of software will hold your passwords for you, and you can have one password for it, and then get all your other passwords coughed up by that particular software. I recommend letting some serious password managers create your password as well as keep it. That way you have one password you really need to remember, the one for the password manager, and you can have many others that are truly hard to crack at your disposal. For instance, there's software, one of them is KeePass 2 is what's out now, I think, and this is free software. And so what you do with it is you have it create a password for you, and then you set it up in the software and say you use it for some online thing you go to, and you say, hey, there you are, tell me when I go there what the password is. And then when you need to get into it, you can use like a three-word password, and it'll cough up that big password. You copy it, you paste it, and you get in. And you could do like a 72-character password. Not every place allows a big password. Not every place allows the same characters. I've run into things where people say, oh, on our site or for our service, you can use any kind of character you like. And then, you know, you start querying them because it doesn't work. And they say, oh, you can't use that. People don't even have a clue about their own software and their own websites and their own services. Oh boy, I had to change a credit card password this past week because I realized, oh, I got that password in the 20th century. Oh, it's a big password. It's a serious password. So I said, I'll just make a new one. And I set one up, and I had to jump through hoops because the credit card company, while I was getting the password, they very rapidly logged me out, but they let me keep applying to change the password. And I'm saying, what is this? So I eventually bailed and went back in And then I was able to do it pretty rapidly. And they also have very few extra characters that you can use. Like, they had like six characters, like an exclamation point, an equal sign, an at sign, a dollar sign, stuff like that. I personally like it when you can use a base 95 character set, because that's everything you can print off a regular computer without going into really fancy stuff and do images and things. And, oh boy, if you get like a 72-character password that's based on base 95, nobody's going to crack that crap. But anyway, so get a password manager, and those can be very, very helpful. And you don't have to remember all the stuff, but you have a very difficult-to-crack set of passwords at your disposal. The National Cybersecurity Center also suggests that users should save passwords to their browser. This lets users easily log into websites, but it also helps protect them against some cybercrime, because some password managers won't work if the website is a fake version of the website designed to steal credentials. They also recommend two-factor authentication wherever possible. It's a pain in the ass, but my bank uses it and we have to use it. And also, here's a statistic. It is being estimated that 3 billion phishing emails are sent every day. 3 billion phishing emails. I remember when phishing first started, it's spelled P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. When it first started, I got one of the first ones. And I talked about it on the air and put it up on my website. And some magazine said, good grief. And they were citing my website and that page for that, because nobody else was addressing it, really. Yeah, phishing emails are terrible. I get bombarded with them. What I get is I get, oh, there's a problem with your email, or your email up at glib.com is about to expire. And it's signed by the administrator of glib.com. And it says, oh, it's all this stuff. And they have various things. Either it's about to expire or somebody tried to break into your account or whatever. Please go here and fix everything. And they give you a link. And you click on the link thinking you're going to your email provider's website. It's not that. It's the phishing people. It's the cyber criminals' website. And then they ask you to give your username and your password and all of that. And, oh boy, now they've got all that stuff. Of course, for me, when they say, oh, this is the admin at glib.com, I say, ha, 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 I'm the admin at glib.com, so bite my shiny metal ass. Yeah, I've gotten pretty good at avoiding getting nailed by phishing stuff. On the other hand, they get more and more sophisticated all the time, and it's possible someday they'll nail me.
Well, I hope not. We've already had family members nailed, not through any fault of their own. 3 family members had their financial institution get, I guess, hacked, the entire institution, and they, along with several tens of millions of other people, had all their information taken. So,
yeah.
You know, and the big, what's the big result of it? Oh, we'll give you 5 years of free credit, whatever. You know, we're going to look at the credit, and that's it. You know, it's like, gee whiz.
Well, you had to change your credit card once because of the big Target hack.
Oh, yes.
And they stole all the passwords, and just to make sure, you had to change your credit card and all of that. So.
Yes. Well, that's nothing like having your name, address, your social number. Yeah. I mean, that's just terrible, terrible.
Yeah, that becomes identity theft, which is really awful. And I'm seeing that Scientific American is recommending that instead of saying that we're dealing with climate change, they say it's time to call it a, quote, climate emergency, unquote. And there's a good chance that they're right. 2020 seems to be the hottest year on record. And the past decade seems to be the hottest decade on record. We've been watching the numbers rise, and now we're seeing more and more that the sea level is rising too. Glaciers are melting. Storms are fiercer and more frequent. That's because the atmosphere has more energy in it, and so it can do that. The first time I heard anyone talking about the idea that the extra energy from the global warming, as we called it back then, would make storms more frequent and more fierce by driving higher winds. First time I heard anybody talking about that, it was me on this radio program. And it was just speculation back then. Now we can see that it's really happening. It's happening all over the place. So this is very seriously bad stuff. All right, 1-212-209-2950. Please call that number and say you want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. BAI buddy is a sustaining membership. And you call 1-212-209-2950 and you say, hey, I want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. Tell them how much you would like taken out of your credit card or your debit card every month and what day of the month you want it done, and they'll do it. You can also call the same number, 1-212-209-2950, and say, I want to make a one-time donation in the name of Back of the Book. We'd really like it if you could do that for us. Oh, there's Mr. Outro music. All right, that has been it for Back of the Book for this week. We'll be back here again next week, and coming up next is the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, and at 7 o'clock this morning is Jim Freund with his program Hour of the Wolf, which is all about science fiction stuff. All right, thanks a hell of a lot for listening, and thank you also if you pledged any amount of money, and we'll be back next week. It's getting nice. Some of these days are really nice. Have a good time looking out the window. And if you've been vaccinated enough and you're feeling brave, put on a mask anyway and go on out and enjoy things. And above all, remember what that making sure he has a damned strong password Dormouse said.
So many people, but it's got no soul, and it's taking you so long to find out you were wrong when you thought it held everything.
It's autumn. The Birds and Ear Massage are migrating to Sundays, 6 to 8 a.m. I'm Mark Leosa, your ear masseur, inviting you to give ear to ear massage, sound, spoken word, a bit of opera, and maybe music you never heard before, including the Bird of the Week. Ear massage between Jeff Brady in other news and your morning Ursae with James Ursae here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Ear massage.
I'm David Kenny of Everything Old is New Again. Every Sunday night at 10, please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
Hi, this is Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.
Hello. This is Mike Pinder, co-founder of the Moody Blues. You're listening to WBAI, New York.
It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up. Stand up, you've been sitting way too long.
Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scrovan, along with my co-host David Feldman. Hello, David.
Hello, everybody.
Nice to have you here. And the man of the hour, Ralph Nader. Hello, Ralph.
Hello, everybody.
On the show today, we're going to spend the whole hour with journalist and publisher John R. MacArthur. He's the subject of a recent article in the New York Times that chronicles his colorful tenure at the helm of Harper's Magazine. He has steered the